Good morning, everybody. Monday morning, January 31st, last day of January, 8 a.m. We're doing Chem 12BL, and we were just talking about the state of the course right now, sort of where things are at. The Canvas shell is now up and running. We've had two classes now. First one, introductory. Second one, we did mostly on laboratory notebooks. We started to do some formal report stuff. And I spent a lot of time last night looking over formal reports and thinking about how to adjust my teaching with formal reports. And that's kind of where I wanted to start today. I believe that what we went over last time was the formal report guidelines that I had written up. We did not look at the formal report rubric yet. And so today what I wanted to do was take that formal report rubric and take a look at that. And also take a look at a couple of journal articles and how journal articles are really structured. I mean, we went through those guidelines of what I want in a formal report, but those guidelines are still very hard to put into practice without a good example. And so I've got two examples that I think I want to look at, one from the literature that I chose and one from a past student that was a fairly good formal report that I've used in the past as sort of a guidelines to look at. Now, the hard thing about the formal report that I want to look at is that it is one of our one of the reports that I'm going to be asking you guys to do. And so I don't want that to go out as so much as this is what you need to do to copy it. More so just to give you an idea of what the sections are supposed to look like, what's supposed to go in the sections and what I'm supposed to do or what you're supposed to do. The other thing that I would say is that I showed you guys this book earlier. I showed you a couple of them. I showed you the ACS style guide. And then this one is a short guide to writing about chemistry. This is by Davis Tyson and Pinchinick. And I've never actually gone through and read this entire book, but I did last night. I didn't read it like you would a novel, but I read it in terms of its content and everything that's in the chapters and looking at some of their language suggestions and ways of writing. And this thing is fantastic. This is actually a really, really good resource because it breaks down the language that you should be using, good examples, bad examples, how to correct bad examples. And it looks at it section by section and what should be going into the different sections. And so outstanding resource in terms of its writing. Maybe I need to think about making that one of the resources for the lab class that is a mandatory resource and going through it. Normally, the way that I think about lab, particularly first semester, is I don't think about first semester as a huge investment in writing. I generally think about first semester as a huge investment in laboratory techniques and teaching you the laboratory techniques and starting from the basics and going all the way through to more complicated techniques. And so we spend all of our time and focus and energy on what we're doing in the physical laboratory and learning to work with the chemicals. But we can't do that right now. We'll be going back into that, but what do we do in the intervening time? And so that's why so much attention to putting on writing. Usually I do this more second semester, but even second semester when we do it, I don't do it to the degree that we're going to do it here. But I think this is good because writing is so much of what you need to do. And as you go on, they don't teach you those writing skills. It's not like you go on, you're going to get those writing skills someplace else. Those writing skills, this is where they should be taught. And as you go through and you go, usually somebody who's going into chemistry goes through quantitative analysis, they go through physical chemistry. The lab reports just become more intense and more writing, and yet not a whole lot more teaching in terms of writing. They just expect you to be able to go and do it. So, so this is important. Okay, let me pull up that rubric and remind you where things are located. So I'm going to open up a new browser window. And then I'm going to share that window. And let's go to chemed.study. We'll go to the 12AL page and the laboratory notebook rubric, which comes up in PDF here. And then I'm going to pull this open with preview. And then I'm going to suck it down onto my iPad. And then we'll actually do the read through on the iPad, because that'll give me the ability to zoom in easier, make some notations. Okay, and the other thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to bring in this paper that I've got that I'm going to look at. And I'm going to bring in the professional paper first, then maybe we'll take a look at the other one. Okay, let me get back to you guys. And then stop this share and share the iPad. Let's see, and how do I do that by case? So much coordination. All right, boom. All right, everybody see the screen share, the laboratory notebook rubric, what we're doing here. And I'm also going to get the chat up because I haven't seen anything come across, but just in case. Okay, the other thing that that I have a hard time with is, I'm going to profess to a few things that I have a hard time with, is that teaching writing requires you guys to read and write, which requires sometimes some activities that that you're participating in within the class in a different way than participating with the laboratory exercise. And I'm used to that laboratory exercise and that turning you guys loose and having you active throughout the classroom, having music on, having a lot of laughter, having a lot of things going on. I'm used to that organized chaos of the lab. Having people sit down and do some quiet things and some writing and reading and puts me on edge for some reason, and I'm not used to it. So there's going to be some adjustment on my end on looking at some of these things as well. Okay, laboratory notebook. All right, did I lose you? Come back. There it goes. Flopped a couple of times. I think my cable is unsteady. That's not good. All right. Maybe it'll come back. Stop the share and try one more time. It's never done that before. Okay, looks like it's working again. All right. So in the laboratory notebook, what we break it down into is, it says it's screen sharing, but it doesn't look like I'm on the wrong screen. Hang on, I'm sorry, I apologize. It usually doesn't take this much effort. It is just not working the way that it's supposed to. Screen share, yeah, iPad, iPhone, go and show me the screen share. It's not showing me the window. Can you guys see the window? Because I'm not getting anything on my end. No, okay. Take two. I will be right back. I'm going to get a different cable. Fortunately, I've got numerous. Okay. Second cable. Troubleshoot if this is the iPad or the cable. Stop share and try it again. Share screen, iPad. All right, did that come up? That does not look like it came up on my side either. I'm getting no. Problematic. Now my app's gonna freeze. As long as I don't lose you guys. All right, second option. Since that's not working. Sort that out later. I have a second and third option. One of these options is going to work. Boy Scout motto, always be prepared. Chem Lab notes. Share screen. Via cable. Okay. That worked. Now what I need to do is get everything into this iPad. This will take just a minute again. Okay. Now we should be able to see that. Now I can use my pen and my pointer, and that is disconcerting that my other iPad finally cracked out. I'll try to work that out later. Okay. As I was saying before, we've got organization, heading, data, and legal component. So the rubric, in terms of how the rubric breaks things down, it doesn't break it down by every section. It breaks it down just into, of course I grabbed the laboratory notebook one. Not the formal report one. You get flustered with the iPad and then things all go to hell. Okay, better. Formal written laboratory report rubric. We've got it broken down by abstract, introduction, methods and materials, results, discussion and conclusion, language, grammar, and formatting. And as I said before, the language, the grammar, and the formatting are stripped out. There we go. Okay. I couldn't see if you were seeing the same thing I was seeing or not. And so let's go through, let's look at exemplary for the abstract and what's included in the abstract. So the abstract is said to be between 80 to 200 words, written in past tense, describes the work that was done and the results found without using experimental details. So it really is what was done, what was found. That's the main component of what the rubric is supposed to do. Or what the, my brain's all fried because I'm upset because I couldn't get all my things in the right spot at the right time. What the abstract is supposed to do. The abstract is supposed to tell you what was done and what was found without including a whole bunch of experimental details. Now, the 80 to 200 words is loose. It doesn't have to be exactly at least 80 words. You know, if two sentences can do it for an abstract, great. Two sentences will do it. If it requires more, great. But it's usually a single paragraph. And of limited content, because you want it to just tell very concisely what was done and what was found. So the 80 to 200 is kind of a loose component there. Adequate, scope of work not sufficiently described or too lengthy, not completely in past tense, some critical results missing. So things start to break down. It doesn't have all the critical results. It's either too short or it's too long, not completely in the right tense. Things start to break down. Developing, scope of work not sufficiently described or too lengthy. Experimental details included, like you're putting in temperatures, you're putting in amounts, you're putting in how long something was reacted, those types of things. Some critical results missing. You don't have the results in there. You're trying to tell me what was done in too much detail, but not what was found. Written in the wrong tense, few unneeded sentences. There's things in there that just don't need to be in there. That's developing. So let's take a look at an abstract for a paper. And as I said, the paper that I wanted to look at was this paper on what are called aminoborohydrides. Now, the chemistry of this is not going to make sense. Because the chemistry is more advanced than we're ready for. And in fact, since we're just starting with organic chemistry, we have no sense of organic chemical reactions or what they're going to do. So in that regards, I tried to look at papers last night that were very beginning papers that had to do with chemical structure and things that were from the 1960s on up through the 1980s. And the journals are written in such a way from that time period that the structures are hard to read. And even the papers were of too long a length. And so it was hard to find a paper that I wanted. And so I picked something newer that was well written and also of a journal where the structures were easy to see. And the reason that I chose this paper in particular has to do with the first author, Shannon Thomas.
Is the fact that it was done at UC Santa Cruz part of why you used it?
Not so much that it was done at UC Santa Cruz, but more so because I know Shannon. And Shannon was one of the most impressive writers that I knew. So Bogdan Singaram was my research advisor. And Shannon was one of my colleagues. She was a grad student at the same time that I was a grad student. And Shannon was the daughter of two college professors, both English professors. And her writing was impeccable. And so anytime any of us were writing anything, we would always have Shannon read it and edit it for us. And her articles were just always stellar, which is why I've chosen one of her papers to go from. And this seemed to be a paper where, as I read through it, it wasn't that the chemistry was more accessible, but her writing is just really clear and really good. And that's why I chose it. So this is a paper, as I said, on aminoborohydrides. This is a style of title that that was preferred by a gentleman named H.C. Brown. H.C. Brown is deceased now. He's a Nobel Prize-winning chemist. H.C. Brown was Bogdan Singerom's advisor, and he won the Nobel Prize for a reaction called hydroboration within organic chemistry. And he would do these papers where he would do hydroboration, and then he would have a number. And so they would be a series of papers. And so you knew whether you were reading the 16th paper, the 14th paper, the 23rd paper, the 50th or 60th paper. He would always do them in sequence so that you knew what number in the series you were reading and how they were related to one another. And so Bogdan did this with his aminoborohydrides. He started to number them in sequence. And this is the 14th paper, lithium aminoborohydrides in the selective reduction or amination of alkyl methyl sulfonate esters. And so this is a paper that is describing two possible reactions, selective reduction or amination, and of a particular type of substrate called a methane sulfonate ester. And you can see that the authors are all listed after the title. This is what's called the byline or the credits. It comes from the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of California, Santa Cruz. The corresponding author's email address is right there. And the date that this was received for publication, not the date that it was published, but the date that it was received for publication. And then they go into the abstract. And this has what is called a graphical abstract, as well as a written abstract. So not all papers are amendable to a graphical abstract, but some journals will print them both in the graphic and in the text version. And you can see here that starting from a particular substrate, the reaction can go to the right or the reaction can go to the left, producing either a reduction or this is an amination where they're making an amine out of it. And this is the sulfonate ester that they're talking about. And the abstract here, lithium aminoborohydride lab. So they have defined an abbreviation that they will use now throughout the paper. Reagents initiate the amination or reduction of alkyl methyl sulfonate esters as dictated by reaction conditions. Alkyl methyl sulfonate esters treated with unhindered labs provide tertiary amines and excellent yield. Reduction to the corresponding alkane is achieved using hindered lab reagent or by forming the highly reactive superhydride reagent in situ using lab and catalytic amount of triethylborane. The reduction methodology disclosed herein is a safe and convenient alternative to existing synthetic methods. So what was done and what was found? Notice that there are no temperatures. Notice that there are no times. There are no amounts. There are no reaction conditions given in the abstract. It simply is what was done and what was found. And then that last sentence here that really says why it's important. The reduction methodology disclosed herein is safe, convenient, and is an alternative to existing methods. So these things have been done before, but maybe they weren't done with super safe or convenient reactions. And that's what this paper is going to tell you is why this methodology is better than existing methodology. And so it's just that there's nothing in that abstract that doesn't need to be there. Everything does a purpose. Tells you exactly what was done, what was found without any experimental details. and also stimulates interest. Okay, back up here to the next part, introduction. The introduction describes the motivation and focus of the experiment, contains appropriate theoretical background without errors. Last paragraph is non-technical overview of the experiment. So without errors, contains appropriate theoretical background without errors. As we go forward, or as we go back in terms of accomplished, describes the motivation and focus of the experiment, contains appropriate theoretical background with minor errors, non-technical overview, too technical. That contains appropriate theoretical background. The theoretical background, why something works, how it works, the mechanism of how it works is oftentimes complicated. And one of the places where students tend to start to make mistakes, they make mistakes in the mechanism itself of the reaction that's taking place. And so the difference between exemplary and accomplished is the ability to do that theoretical background without making any mistakes in your introduction of the theoretical background versus making minor errors. Adequate describes the motivation and focus of the experiment, theoretical background incomplete or containing errors. Non-technical overview incomplete or too technical. This non-technical overview, what is this? The non-technical overview is a segue between what was previously done, what's called prior art, and what you're about to talk about. It's a way of moving from the past to what is about to be described. That's what the non-technical overview's job is, or at least that's a way that I've come to phrase it as a non-technical overview. It just sort of like you go through all this history of why this thing is important, and now I'm going to give you just a little brief paragraph about what's about to come. Tell them what you're going to tell them. And then you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. That's sort of the way the papers work. And so the non-technical overview is not very long generally. Generally, it's a fairly short thing. And in Shannon's paper, it's actually really short and just at the very end of what happens here. So her overview here, alkyl and aryl methyl sulfonate esters are important reagents in organic synthesis. And then she has a reference and a paper in synthesis that talks about why those things are so important. She doesn't explain it in great detail, but gives you a reference to back up a statement like that. They have excellent leaving group properties, are readily available, and are common intermediates for the deoxygenation of alcohols to their parent alkanes. So this is a way of removing alcohols and going back to the parent alkanes. Deoxygenation of alcohols to alkanes is a common synthetic transformation that is usually achieved by reducing the sulfonate ester derivatives with lithium aluminum hydride. Each statement that she makes, she backs up with a reference. Notice the way that the references are given. The references are given with a superscript at the end of the sentence following the period. They always proceed in numerical order from 1 to 2 to 3. And then they're given as footnotes, or they could be given as endnotes depending upon the journal that you're submitting to, but generally as footnotes at the end. And each one is a complete full citation. LAH, lithium aluminum hydride reductions of primary alkyl sulfonates generally proceed with satisfactory results, whereas sterically hindered alkyl sulfonates treated with lithium aluminum hydride suffer from unfavorable side reactions, elimination, and sulfur oxygen bond cleavage. Again, she goes back to reference 3 because all those things are in the same reference. So she's referencing that article twice. But when she references it twice, notice that it's only written here once. In fact, once we use a reference, if we want to reference that paper again later in the article, we simply throw the number down. We don't reprint the reference. We just put the number back down. It's already been referenced. And so we can use that reference as many times as we need to once we've referenced it. For reactions where lithium aluminum hydride cannot be used, lithium triethyl borohydride, and then they give an abbreviation for lithium, the 3-ethyl borohydride. So this is an abbreviation for lithium triethyl borohydride. I'm going to read the abbreviations because I know that that is one of the major hard parts of reading a paper is remembering what a abbreviation actually stands for. Or superhydride is an excellent alternative, reference number 4. However, for complete reduction, 2 equivalents of the highly reactive lithium triethyl borohydride is required, and oxidation of the resulting trialkyl borane complicates the workup procedures in a large-scale reaction. So right there, she's citing a problem, past history, something that is going to be solved by this paper. Lithium aminoborohydrides lab. Now, this is the first time she's used this, even though she used it in the abstract and defined it there. The first time it's used in the paper, she'll redefine it. Because sometimes people will just go to start reading the paper without reading the abstract. And so you want to make sure that the first time you use an abbreviation, it's in the paper. Lithium aminoborohydride lab reagents have recently emerged as a new class of powerful and selective reducing agents, 5, that could potentially carry out the deoxygenation of alcohols to their alkanes. However, under certain circumstances, lithium aminoborohydrides preferentially transfer their amine functionality over a hydride. For example, both unsubstituted and substituted benzyl halides treated with lithium aminoborohydride reagents at 0°C give the corresponding tertiary amine borane complexes, whereas the same reaction at 65°C affords toluene products. There is thus a difference in the reactivity of lithium aminoborohydrides towards alkyl hydrides with temperature. Additionally, lithium aminoborohydride reagents undergo a unique reaction with 2 halobenzonitriles, reference 7. During this reaction, reduction of the nitrile is accompanied by amination of the carbon bearing the halogen, and 2 aminobenzylamines are obtained. Clearly, lithium aminoborohydride reagents are capable of mediating the transfer of both their amine and hydride functionalities. Exploring and ultimately controlling this dual reactivity is desired. Now, here is what I call the non-technical overview. Herein, we report the controlled reactivity of lithium aminoborohydrides towards alkyl sulfonates as modulated by temperature, steric bulk, and the in situ generation of superhydride. So that piece right there, that's the non-technical overview. It's just that part. All the rest of it that came before that is all part of what we would call the prior art or the introduction. And so all of that continues through a few paragraphs until we get into that break right there where we do the non-technical overview at the end of that. Then what this paper does in this journal, which is a little bit different than some other journals, is that there are not breaks that tell you what part of the paper you are in. So as we've come in through the introduction, There was nothing that said introduction. And then as you leave the introduction and you start in on the discussion, there's nothing that tells you that you're about to start the discussion. So this part here, here you're about to start the discussion component in that breakdown. And in this discussion, she has lots of tables that are in here. She's got a difference between a table and a figure. So we'll go over that difference. A few more figures, a table two. And then she gets into the conclusion of her article and the acknowledgement and supporting information. What there isn't in this type of article is there is not a good section for results and a clear section for methods and materials. So we'll have to go to a different journal article for that. But the writing in this article is just really clear and really accurate for what she's trying to do. All right, let's go take a look at what needs to happen in the discussion section. So in the discussion section, notice I'm skipping over the methods and materials and results. We'll come back to those later in maybe a different article. And I have another article of Shannon's from a different journal, which does highlight out those things. The discussion and conclusion section here, looking at exemplary. Results analyzed to produce sound conclusions. All experimental difficulties, errors, questions discussed correctly. The last paragraph is conclusion, expressing briefly the bottom line of the experiment. It's basically a restatement of the abstract. And it's sort of that abstract is tell them what you're going to tell them. Then you go through, and this section is the part where you tell them, and then the conclusion is tell them what you told them. It's a restatement of that again. Remember, I said a lot of these sections are redundant, and they serve different purposes. And so this component here is where we tell them all about and analyze everything that goes on, what we found, how it works. Usually there's a component here that goes through and describes the mechanism in great detail, and all of the experiment about what happened and what went wrong, what went right, all of those types of things. It's a little bit different between a published paper and what I'm going to expect you guys to do, but I'm going to pull in this other student paper and look at that as well, and we'll take a look at that, what goes on there. What is the difference when it starts to break down? So this is accomplished. Results analyzed to produce sound conclusions. All experimental difficulties, errors, questions discussed with some minor error, meaning that you may be interpreting them incorrectly. The last paragraph is conclusion, expressing briefly the bottom line of the experiment. So the conclusion needs to be there as well. Adequate. Results analyzed. Experimental difficulties, errors, questions discussed. Some answered incorrectly. Conclusion too small or too lengthy and or missing the bottom line. As we fall down into developing, results analyzed, producing some incorrect conclusions. Experimental difficulties, errors discussed incompletely, things are left out. Some questions answered incorrectly. Conclusion not well developed, too lengthy or too short, and missing the bottom line. So you can see that there's just this degradation of everything is there and done the way that it's supposed to be done. Some errors start to crop in. Things are either too long, too short, with increasing amount of errors. Again, too long, too short, things missing that are supposed to be there, and increasing number of errors. So that's the way that the rubric kind of breaks it down. Let's take a look this starts to get very technical into Shannon's paper. And I'm thinking that I may want to switch to the other paper before I get into this too much. Let's take a look at her discussion. Let's not read through all of it, but let's read through part of it and see how she starts to break down her results. And let's look at the differences between a table and a figure and how she references them. Primary alkyl methyl sulfonates treated with unhindered lithium aminoborohydride reagents at 0 and 25 degrees Celsius provide only the corresponding tertiary amines. No reduction products are observed by GC analysis. Under these reaction conditions, lithium aminoborohydrides are exclusively amine transfer reagents. For example, 3-phenylpropyl methyl sulfonate, number 1, provides tertiary amines, number 2, in excellent yield with a variety of lab reagents after an acidic methanolic workup procedure, table 1. All right, let's stop there. This is compound 1 that she is referring to. She refers to it by name and then puts in the number 1 to tell you that's what she's working on. Provides tertiary amines, number 2, in excellent yield with a variety of lab reagents. Notice that the way that she structures this is to build in the reagent using the abbreviation for the reagent that's going to be there. But then these are each of the products, 2A, 2B, 2C, 2D, 2E, and each of the lab reagents, the specific lab reagent that is being used. So that would be the part that goes over the arrow here. And she's done it in general form, showing all the reactions that were done in one table. And that's why this is listed as a table, is because it shows not a single reaction, but it is a table of results of multiple reactions. And this is the way that most authors will choose to do it, is they'll set up the general, they'll set it up so that you get a general product, the general conditions, and then each of those specific conditions and each product broken down, and each product gets a number so that it can be handled by name and also in the, down here where she's got her procedure. The procedures can be broken down. Hers is going to be in the ancillary information. Each one of these products would be described and listed by name and by number elsewhere in the publication, so that you could look at how each one of them was actually produced and the procedure that was given to produce those. So tables are a table of information, maybe slightly different than you would think of a table. It doesn't have all the table grids and lines, but everything is put in tabular format. And each one of the yields is given 92, 75, 94, 87, 99. And so we can see the yields from each one of those. That's different than a figure. A figure generally shows just a single reaction, or even a single structure can be a figure. Notice the difference in the way that a table, the caption for the table always goes above a table. Because of the way that tables are done, and tables are a more complicated piece of information and they're generally lengthy, we generally put the caption for the table at the top. It always goes table 1, starting with the first table, the title of that table, and then the preceding component of the table. Where the table comes in, table 1, is generally close in text to where that table is being described. If another table is presented in the article, it comes up as table 2. She's got another one in here. I'm going to run down and find it. Here's table 2. And so notice that the figures run consecutively on their own. There is a table 1, and there is a figure one, and then a figure two and a figure three. And so each of the different types, tables, figures, schemes, all have their own captions. They all start table one, table two, table three, figure one, figure two, figure three, scheme one, scheme two, scheme three. They all go consecutive in order as they are presented. And as I said, the figures are generally standalone single reactions rather than a table. And the figure, because figures are generally smaller in scope and show a smaller amount of information, the caption for a figure goes directly below the figure instead of above. They're done exactly the same way. Table one, figure one in bold, period. And then the caption that describes what's going on in that figure. Temperature-dependent differences in boron species generated during the reaction of one with lab. Species characterized by coupled and decoupled boron NMR spectra, nuclear magnetic resonance spectra. Okay, I think that's as much as I want to get into in terms of reading this. I think what I want to do is I want to jump to the student version of this and start to show kind of how the student version of this goes together. How are you guys doing? You're following along? We're following with the rubric. Just checking in to see if there's any questions. Okay. Let me see. I don't think I brought in the student paper yet. Let me go bring in the student paper. Actually, I think what I'm going to do is I'm also going to bring in Shannon's other paper so that you can see another example of Shannon's papers. And then we won't read through that one. I'm just going to show it there because it has the breakdown of the different parts of the paper. And then I'll bring in this paper. So new windows open. Okay. This is another of Shannon's papers. This is out of the Journal of Organic Chemistry. The previous paper was in Organic Letters. So the title of this journal is over here, Organic Letters. It was a little bit more accessible than this paper, which is why I chose to show it. But this is the Journal of Organic Chemistry, JORGCHEM. And the Journal of Organic Chemistry is the journal that I am going to have you guys follow the template for. It is a, there are so many journals to choose from, but really it is the most appropriate of all of the American Chemical Society journals for organic chemistry to follow as a template wise. And this is what I'm going to have you guys do. Again, just breaking down the article title, the byline, each one of the authors. The last author is always considered to be the corresponding author. So you can see the star that follows that. The first, the way the authors break down, just so you know, when you're looking at journal articles, these are all people who worked on the project. The first author is generally the person who wrote the journal article. They're the person who did the bulk of the work, and they're the person who actually did the writing most of the time. The last authors, particularly if they're at different institutions, are generally the authors who are guiding the work. So Christian T. Gorowski has a double dagger on his name. That is going to be down here someplace down at the bottom, that's going to have his contact information. The star is generally the corresponding author. This is the PI, the principal investigator. This is the professor, essentially. All the other people are generally considered to be either graduate students or undergraduates. Anybody that has a symbol next to their name is generally somebody who already has their PhD and is working at different institutions, which is why they get highlighted out individually. And then that corresponding author, their corresponding information is there, singaram@chemistry.ucse.edu, and then received the abstract. This one definitely does break down by introduction. And so we would go to the introduction of the work. You get through the introduction, and then at the end of the introduction should be the non-technical overview. So additionally, lab reagents had not been found to react with aryl halides such as bromobenzene, chlorobenzene, or fluorobenzene. However, aryl halides containing the cyano group behaved differently with lab reagents and gave a uniquely novel reaction. In this paper, the results of this new reaction between lab reagents and two halobenzonitriles is disclosed. Again, there's sort of that non-technical overview at the end of the introduction, that segue between prior art, what was done, and what we're about to tell you. This then goes through the results of the discussions. It's a two-column format. We won't do the two-column format because that gets too complicated. I don't want you to have to deal with all that formatting issue. We'll do a single column, but all the same content will be there. You go through the results and the discussion, and the results and the discussion then is breaking down what was found and all of the mechanism in detail that goes into that. You get through the results and discussion section. There's a bunch of tables and figures and all of that stuff. And then it gets through to the conclusion, which is a restatement of the abstract. In summary, a novel tandem amination reduction reaction of two halobenzonitriles with lithium NN dialkyl aminoborohydride reagents has been discovered. And then it goes into the rest of the article there. And then there's the experimental section. It goes through the general methods, the general procedure. And then in a two-column format, when you finish over here, you come back and you start in the first column. You finish the end of that column, you come back, you start at the next column. Let's go look at the experimental section and what I was looking for. Let me go all the way back up here. Methods and materials. This is the experimental section. The lab manual and other materials properly cited. Deviations, additions, omissions are clearly expressed in paragraph format. This alone does not tell you enough about what is supposed to be there and what that format looks like. I'm going to go back. It was on the other. What I need to do. I want to go back from the notes, but that was on my other iPad. And so the only way that I can show you this since the other iPad is not working is to share with you this screen, our lab Zoom recordings, and our lecture notes. Where this was the document organic chemistry formal written laboratory reports. This was the document that tells you what the formatting, the title, the abstract, the introduction, and then we get into the methods and materials. And this tells you everything that was supposed to be done here. All reagents used should be listed and sources cited. Chemical one, chemical two, chemical three were obtained from the stockroom used without modification. Make and model of instruments, all of that stuff. And remember, I gave you that example. So this was the example from a Grignard experiment. And it had all of the materials broken out. And then all the equipment broken out. And then the procedure followed that. So the first thing that you do is you list your materials and your equipment, and then you list your procedure. That's what this article does. So I'm going to show you how that works in this article. Here we go. All reactions were performed in oven-dried, nitrogen-cooled apparatus. All air and moisture-sensitive compounds were introduced via syringes or cannula through a rubber septum. THF was distilled with sodium benzophenone. So it says how the THF was handled. NMR spectra were recorded in CDCl3, deuterated chloroform. Chemical shifts are reported relative to TMS, and it tells what that is for zero, for proton NMR, and are referred to the CDCl3 resonance at 77 for carbon NMR, for carbon NMR spectra. Boron NMR samples were run neat and referenced to BF3 etherate as zero. For boron NMR spectra, mass spectra were obtained on a mass spectrometer in TIS. We don't need to go into all of that. But then they go into the chemicals. Here we go. The 2-bromobenzonitrile, 2-chlorobenzonitrile, and 2-fluorobenzonitrile were purchased from Acros Chemical Company and used without further purification. The 4-methylbenzonitrile, 3, all of these were purchased from Aldrich Chemical Company and were used without further purification. The NN-dimethylamine borane was donated from the Calorie Chemical Company. So they say where all the chemicals were obtained and that they were used without modification. You're not going to know exactly where your chemicals are coming from, but they're going to come out of the Cabrillo stockroom and used without modification. And that's as much as we're going to need to report there in terms of where our chemicals are coming from. General procedures, then they go through the actual procedure of what was done. And I'm not going to get into those in too much detail. We're going to look more at a procedure for us that's more appropriate for us, that's going to make a little more sense as we go through and read that procedure. And let's take a look at this article. This is an article that was written by a Chem 12 student that I've taken and used as a good template. And I think that what I'm going to do actually is I'm going to take and actually make a template for you guys that's going to allow you to cut and paste into that template, that's going to have some comments, that's going to remind you of what needs to be in each section to make this a little bit easier. And I think it's going to be a lot based off of this. So as I said, this is a student-made paper. You can see that the title is here, stands alone, the small scale synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid, in parentheses, aspirin. The title doesn't say something new, doesn't say something novel, it just says exactly what was done. And small scale is the type of chemical apparatuses that we use. It's the scale at which we do chemistry within our chemistry class. Small scale is small scale. It's not huge. It's a scale that is usually somewhere between maybe half a millimole on up to maybe 5 millimoles is the largest that you would do at this scale of chemistry. And it uses glassware that is probably no more than 5 to 25 mils. And so it is a known type of scale. The student's name. Now I've changed the student's name. Fred Slackenerny is one of my favorite characters out of PhD Comics. And then same thing, the byline, Cabrillo College, Chem 12A, Aptos, California, submitted November 30th, 2011. And so it models exactly what was done in the previous things, only there's one student who's writing this paper. If you work in a group and you're doing the experiment together and you coordinate on writing the experiment, then you guys would have both your names here and the same sort of format. Abstract, salicylic acid was reacted with concentrated phosphoric acid and acetic anhydride to create a salicylic acid at 74.1% yield. The negative ferric chloride test and the melting point of 132.4 to 135.7 were consistent with a pure result. But the infrared spectrum showed a peak as 34 to 7.89 reciprocal centimeters, inconsistent with literature values. The abstract says what was done and what was found. There's some grammatical issues that are in this abstract, but by and large, it does a really good job of saying what was done and what was found without experimental details. There's nothing in here that tells me how the experiment was done, but it is giving me the actual numeric results. And so the results are there. And when it's consistent with literature values, it's telling me, and when it's not, it's also telling me. Introduction. This is where you want to stimulate interest from your reader and tell them why it's important. The discovery of salicylic acid as a great new pain reliever. Oh, wait, before we do that, let's do something here. Let's grab that rubric. I'm going to bring the rubric in one more time. And then we can score this with the rubric where it sits. I didn't want to zoom all the way back and forth. So what I'm doing is I'm just grabbing it and bringing it in one more time at the bottom of this article. So we don't have to zoom back and forth so much. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to score this. Salicylic acid was reacted with concentrated phosphoric acid and acetic anhydride to create acetylsalicylic acid. I would say at is not maybe the right word there, that we need in 74% yield. The negative ferric chloride test and melting point of 132.4 to 135.7 were consistent with a pure result. Actually, I never actually liked that phrasing of pure result either. That is not what we're trying to say. That maybe we're consistent with literature values. But the infrared spectrum showed a peak at 3,427.89 reciprocal centimeters. That was inconsistent with the product. Something like that. All right, so when we go to the rubric here, we're looking at the abstract. Between 80 and 200 words written in past tense describes the work that was done and the results found without using experimental details. Accomplished, between 80 to 200 words, scope of work incomplete or too detailed, written in past tense describes the work that was done, results that was found without using experimental details. scope of work not sufficiently described or too lengthy, not completely in past tense, some critical missing elements. There's nothing in here about grammar, because grammar gets taken all the way down here in language, grammar, and formatting and applies to the overall document itself. So really the abstract, what the abstract is doing is the abstract is written in the past tense, describes work that was done and results that was found without using experimental details. It's really doing exactly what it's supposed to do. So I would say that as we're looking at that, I would put it that the abstract is falling in the exemplary category, and that we're going to ding it for some language, grammar, formatting later. But for right now, that's where it's falling. Let's go take a look at her introduction now. Introduction. The discovery of salicylic acid as a great new pain reliever, fever reducer, and swelling reducer was marred by how acidic it was. Trying to take the new medicine would lead to irritation of the mucus lining from the mouth to the stomach. Organic chemists were interested in finding a way to use this compound but decrease its acidic properties. Success came to Felix Hoffmann, a German chemist with Bayer, when he synthesized acetylsalicylic acid, known commonly as aspirin, by adding an acetyl group to the salicylic acid. The new compound still kept the medicinal properties of salicylic acid, but is less acidic. So the issue there is highlighted. Again, there's some serious writing issues in here that it's really clunky. And there is definitely a way that we could rewrite this to make it more elegant. But the idea that salicylic acid, which was known since Roman times as a pain reliever and as a fever reducer, could only be taken as a natural product steeped as a tea. That if you tried to isolate salicylic acid and take it, it caused great stomach upset, sometimes bleeding ulcers. All kinds of things would happen if you tried to take it as a natural product. And so to decrease that acidity to the stomach, they sought to change and modify the compound while still trying to retain its benefits of fever reduction and of swelling reducer and pain reliever and all of those things. And Felix Hoffmann was a German chemist who figured out a way to do that. Hoffmann added acetyl group, or added an acetyl group, by reacting the hydroxyl group on the ring system in salicylic acid with acetic anhydride. Notice that she's highlighted and used some color here, that here's the hydroxyl group, and this is the acetic anhydride, and this is the group which is being transferred and swapped such that this acete group goes on to the oxygen and the hydrogen is transferred to the other side. The reaction is an esterification that requires an acid catalyst as indicated in, and I don't know where she goes there, but she lost something and should be indicated in figure one. So figure one, esterification of salicylic acid. Figure one, to help the reaction move forward, acetic anhydride was used in excess. The excess reactant pushes the reaction to the product. Actually, what she should have here is because what she's showing is she should highlight the acid quality of that catalyst that needs to go in there. But the figure is done correctly. There's the figure one, there's the caption of the figure. And I think that what she's doing here, figure one, esterification of salicylic acid, it goes in figure one. To help the reaction move forward, acetic anhydride was used in excess. The excess reactant pushes the reaction to the product. Okay, so that's not so bad. I was reading that differently. And then what helps to make sure that you're seeing this as part of the text and seeing this as the caption is the change in font size. And that this is always like font 10.0, whereas the rest of it is in font 12.0. Although the exact mode of action of aspirin is still unknown, synthesizing it in the lab is straightforward. The reaction between salicylic acid and acetic anhydride used as solvent with an acid catalyst Concentrated phosphoric acid at 50 degrees C for 8 to 10 minutes produces acetylsalicylic acid. And she has that in figure 2. So there's the overall reaction that she's doing. And this is serving sort of as her non-technical overview in that she's telling you how the reaction is done. And then she's going to go into her methods and materials. And so now we can go and sort of score that introduction. The introduction, what I'm seeing here, if I were going to score this one, describes the motivation and focus of the experiment, contains appropriate theoretical background without errors. Last paragraph is non-technical overview. Describes the motivation and focus of the experiment, contains appropriate theoretical background with minor errors. I would kind of put her sort of in here or in here, somewhere in this range for this paper. There's more background that could be detailed there in terms of how this salicylic acid causes stomach upset, what's been known about it, and then the detail of what was tried to make it less acidic. And if you go online, even if you just go to Wikipedia, or even in Pavia itself, gives a better detailed description of what was tried in order to make it less acidic, and then what was found by Felix Hoffmann and why Felix Hoffmann actually had this motivation. It wasn't just that Felix Hoffmann was a German chemist who did this. He went and did this because his father was suffering from arthritis and was in great deal of pain. And so he was seeking to try to find a medication that could help his father with the arthritis, and tried multiple experiments, tried multiple things to try to make salicylic acid more palatable and still function. And he hit upon using this acid group to make the ester, and it retained all of the properties that salicylic acid had, but without the stomach upset and all of that. It also started the first pharmaceutical industry, where this medication became hugely popular as one of the first medications that was not just a natural product, was actually modified, and started the pharmaceutical industry. And so you can really think of as aspirin as one of the first pharmaceuticals and the beginning of this making of medications to be able to solve all types of medical problems. So there's lots more that could have gone on there that she could have highlighted. The introduction could have been a bit more detailed. And there's a few things that are missing in there.
Could I add something?
Please.
So the synthesis of aspirin also inspired one of the most common techniques in medicinal chemistry, where you'll acetylate a natural product and examine the activity after that. And in a lot of cases, O-acetylation will magnify the potency of a drug, because for the most common example is the conversion of morphine into heroin. Mm-hmm. And another example is the conversion of THC into THC acetate, both mm-hmm. of which have a significantly greater potency and longer duration of action. And so that's something you see a lot.
You do see that a lot, yes. It is a common thing that not only will they acetylate hydroxyl groups, but we generally take functional groups like that and we start to modify them in different ways and then test them to see how they function. And so there are certain parts of a molecule that you will see that is common for pharmaceuticals, that once we identify a natural product, we also look at that natural product and see what are the different places that we can try to modify that natural product. And this is how we end up with that word derivatives, that we come up with derivatives of these natural products that oftentimes have higher potency for various reasons. Oftentimes they fit into receptors a little bit better, or they're slightly more bioavailable. or they are degraded less by the intestinal system, allowing them to be more biologically available within the body. So there's all kinds of reasons why that's true. It's there's a lot of different ways that we look at modifying those. It's a very, very cool part of chemistry. It's taking and making derivatives of natural products to see if you can increase the potency of those drugs. So yes, it was one of the first examples of that, which is really cool. Thank you for that. All right, let's go back and let's take a look at her methods and materials. The procedure in Pavia was followed with only the following modifications. A sand bath was used to control heat instead of hot water bath. So instead of taking and writing the whole thing down, she decided to just cite the lab manual, which is something that I allow you guys to do. It's nice if you learn how to write a procedure. And so I oftentimes will have students who will take and write out the procedure. And I've shown you an example of that in that paper that I have instructions for how to write a journal article. It shows how to take and break down a procedure and write it out fully. But if you're not modifying it from Pavia and you're just going to reference Pavia, then this is a perfect thing. And notice the reference mark here, one, that's the first thing that she's referencing. And I think she did it as endnotes rather than footnotes. That's fine. However, what I would say is the other thing that's going on up here in this introduction is it's missing references. That all of this here should have some references for many of the things that she's citing, because they weren't just common knowledge. They weren't things that were in her head. She went and found those things someplace, but they weren't cited. Okay, and then the next part, salicylic acid, acetic anhydride, phosphoric acid, 5% aqueous sodium bicarbonate solution, and magnesium phosphate were obtained from the Cabrillo College chemistry stockroom and used without modification. Then the equipment. FTIR spectrum were obtained on a Nicolet Avatar 360 FTIR ESP using Omnic 8.1.210 FTIR software by Thermo Fisher Scientific 2009. Solid FTIR spectrum were taken in a solid potassium bromide pellet pressed to 10 tons in International Crystal Laboratories FTIR 20-ton press. Melting points were obtained in a laboratory devices incorporated Meltemp 2, equipped with a Fluke Corporation 51 kJ thermometer thermocouple. So all of her stuff is there, and this is all spot on perfect with no errors anywhere through that section. So we can go through and where she falls here in terms of methods and materials. Lab manual and other materials properly cited, deviations, additions, omissions clearly expressed in paragraph format. This is where she's falling on that paper in the exemplary category for the methods and materials. Okay. Back into results. The results start a little chunky here. They just throw this table in here, and I think it would be better if there were some text before this rather than just starting off a section with a table. But she has her table one properties of the aspirin sample. This is her yield in milligrams. Oftentimes, it's better to just put the milligram units next to it. Percent yield, 74.1%, which is not bad for this experiment. Melting points, there's missing units. She has the different trials in there. It would be better if we just had the average and reported the average melting point. Acetylsalicylic acid was obtained as white crystals in 74.1% yield following recrystallization out of acetic acid and water. The average melting point of the acetylsalicylic acid was 132.3 to 135.5. There's her average that we needed that was there. Ferric chloride test, salicylic acid positive is violet. Water as a control was slightly yellow. The sample clear with light yellow, meaning that it's consistent with a negative result. A ferric chloride test of the sample was negative for phenols. The infrared spectrum of the sample, figure 12, showed that the sample of acetylsalicylic acid was not a pure sample of acetylsalicylic acid. And I don't know where her figure 12 is. This is figure 10. I think figure 12 got dropped off here somewhere. I'll have to go and look for that. This part could be done a lot better. In discussing the results, I'd like to see a discussion of each of the results. I'd like to see a breakdown of the melting point, the percent yield, the ferric chloride test, and a little bit more detail here about what's happening, why it's happening, what does it mean? Okay. Sophie, I'm sorry, I missed your question there. I'm jumping back. I'm looking. I love salicylic acid for acne, and I'm curious about how the properties of it relate to pain as well as skin issues. The skin issues, I'm less familiar with the skin issues. Salicylic acid and acetylsalicylic acid interrupt the formation of what are called prostaglandins. Prostaglandins are molecules that are hormone-like molecules that are synthesized from long-chain fatty acids. Those prostaglandins usually signal the body to do inflammation. They signal the body to, in pain responses, they signal the body in many different areas of inflammation and pain and regulation. And what aspirin does is it interrupts that prostaglandin synthesis so that the body stops synthesizing those molecules that signal for inflammation and signal for pain. And as the prostaglandin levels drop, then the pain decreases, the inflammation decreases, and it breaks the cycle of inflammation and tissue degradation that's happening that your body normally does when an injury results. And so you get an injury, your body says, hey, we got to tear up some of this tissue that's in here, that's in this injury. We've got to get rid of all the bad stuff, and we've got to start rebuilding the new stuff. In addition, it floods it with all kinds of materials to do that, and that's the inflammation cycle. That inflammation sometimes causes damage as well. And so dropping down the inflammation also drops down the pain and helps your body to start to heal, to stop breaking down so much material. And so it's that prostaglandin synthesis interruption that that aspirin is really doing. You can find a lot more of that online just looking at or Googling mode of action of aspirin. And you can find a lot more related to it. And I think that there is some in our Pavia book as well that talks about prostaglandins and their structure and how aspirin actually inhibits the formation of prostaglandins in the body. So good question. I don't know, though, how it relates to skin issues.
Thank you. Yeah, that actually does make sense. From my knowledge of skincare, I've done a lot of research since I was probably like 10 when I first started getting acne. So that how it reduces inflammation makes a lot of sense because acne basically is like infected pores or inflammation in the skin. So that does make a lot of sense. And I think with it being so acidic, like they had said, that it can't be digested because it's so acidic, it does really well to dry out your skin and dry out that acne while kind of returning the good stuff to your skin. So maybe, that makes a lot of sense.
Maybe it also, you have to be very careful with it though, that one of the side effects too, is that it thins your blood. And so it actually, in disrupting the synthesis of prostaglandins, also disrupts the synthesis of platelets. And so your ability to be able to clot is disrupted with that. And so if you then have an injury, if you're taking aspirin and you're taking a considerable amount of aspirin on a daily basis, over a longer period of time, weeks to months of taking that aspirin, if you're in a car accident or if you fall or you hit a part of your body, you're much more prone to bruising. You're much more prone to having, large bleeding episodes. I can't remember what they're called, but where you get essentially like a giant blood blister underneath the skin because you have a blood vessel that breaks and your body can't clot to stop that bleeding. And so you'll get these large pools of blood underneath the skin, which can be extremely painful in and of themselves. So aspirin also, it has so many things that it does and it does them to such a degree that if aspirin were a new product and it was produced today, it probably would not be over the counter. Aspirin would probably be a prescription drug only because of the different side effects that aspirin can have as well. So we treat it as if it's this thing that we can just take all the time, but actually has a lot of effects that it does, more than just pain relief. So something to be aware of too. The discussion, let's go more into this discussion. So one of the things that I like for you guys to do that we do within all journal articles is that when we understand a reaction mechanism, we understand the chemistry better. And what I like for you to do is for each article that we write, that we go into detail of the reaction mechanism. I force you to go through and break down that reaction mechanism and use language to talk about each step and what's going on. So the mechanism here, the esterification of salicylic acid and acetic anhydride has a six-step mechanism. The first step is protonation of a primary oxygen on the acetic anhydride by phosphoric acid, leaving an oxonium ion, figure 3. So she's got figure 3 up here. If the figure appears above where you're citing it, that's fine. It can appear above or below. Usually we try to get it below, but sometimes for pages, it needs to go up above. So she's showing all of the arrows that are showing the movement of the electrons and the movement of that hydrogen to form what we call an oxonium ion. Hopefully she's going to tell us what happens here. The concentrated phosphoric acid is used as a catalyst to start and help the reaction along. And without the phosphoric acid, the reaction would not run because there would be no free protons to start the mechanism. The positive charge sits on the oxygen, but this increases the partial positive on the double bonded carbon. The salicylic acid is now able to act as a nucleophile and attack that carbon, forming a bond between the acetic anhydride and the salicylic acid. She's doing a fairly good job. The language here could be cleaned up a little bit, but what's happening is by putting this positive charge here on the oxygen, what it does is it increases. So over here, there was a little tiny partial positive. Over here, we've increased the partial positive. And this makes this a stronger nucleophile, stronger electrophile. That then allows this guy to be able to attack that and to make a new bond with it. And it couldn't happen without increasing the electrophilicity of this guy. So this is what we call activation. Is that it has been activated to be a stronger electrophile. And now that next step can take place. So figure 4, nucleophilic attack by salicylic acid. And this is where the bond starts to form. Going through the language here, I'm not going to go through all of it, but she steps through each step showing how that bond is formed and then how the proton is taken away, how that proton is added onto the other side of the molecule. And that creates a good leaving group. So this is what we can then call here a good leaving group. And then that complex breaks down, and electrons push in and leave out, and this whole thing leaves. And this is almost, well, I think she's got it. That's the salicylic acid, so it's done. So this is the final product, and this is the acetyl salicylic acid. Oh, that's where she messed up. She's got a mechanism issue here. That's what's going on. We'll fix her mechanism issue for her. And then this has a proton on it that has a positive charge. And so this should have had the double bond already. This should have had the positive charge, and the electrons are just going back to here. And then that's the relief of the positive charge, and that's the acetylsalicylic acid. All right, so there's a few little mechanistic detail issues. And then she goes through an analysis of the product. And so the analysis of the product here, and this is what she does actually fairly well. The experiment produced 207.5 milligrams of acetylsalicylic acid at 74.1% yield. The percent yield was moderate. Loss may have been due to the experiment not having run to completion or occurred during the separation of the acetylsalicylic acid. To separate the acetylsalicylic acid during the separation, where did she get? Oh, wait, to separate the acetylsalicylic acid from the acetic acid and other impurities, the solution was cooled and the acetylsalicylic acid crystallized within the solution. Water was added to decrease the solubility of the acetylsalicylic acid. Unreacted salicylic acid is the most likely impurity. So she goes through kind of what happened and what may have been one of the sources of error that that happened in the crystallization, and that it may not have fully crystallized. She says acetylsalicylic acid also reacts with water to undo the desired reaction. In fact, the reaction runs in reverse. This is a hydrolysis reaction where it converts back to starting material. And that the water is useful in separating the salicylic acid, but cleaves the bond made in the first reaction, and some product is lost to this competing reaction. So she's giving some reasons here why her percent yield might be lower than it should be, why the percent yield is 74% instead of like 90%. The purity of the product was tested using a ferric chloride test, melting point determination, and infrared spectroscopy. And then she goes through each one of these and highlights how they went. And so notice that she does the ferric chloride test, she does the melting point test, she does the infrared spectroscopy, and she talks about each one of them. And then the conclusion, the synthesis of acetylsalicylic acid using salicylic acid, acetic anhydride, and concentrated phosphoric acid was completed at 74%. The ferric chloride test and melting point showed slight impurity, and the IR spectrum confirmed it. So, and then she has her references that are here. So I would say going back to, she's got her other things that are in here, her results and data presented in table format and discussed in paragraph format, but a few issues that were cited in that. The discussion and conclusion, she had a couple of errors that were in there. And third person was used formally throughout, but she had a few grammatical errors and things that could be resolved overall. And so looking at this report and sort of where this report sits, it's got a 4 for exemplary times 2. It's got 3.4 times 1, 2, 3, 4. And it's got a 3.0. 15.6 and 3. So what do we got? We've got 8 plus 13.6 plus 3, 24.6, and that is out of, I did something wrong. Maybe it's not a total of 24 points. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 times 4 is 24. So 4 times 2 is 8. Oh, I see what I did. I added in an extra one here. Let's call this at 3 of these, and let's give her a 3.0 on that second category. .2 is where we come out at. Why am I having so much trouble with this calculator? 10.2. Okay, so what did she come out with? Divided by 24. 21.2 divided by 24. 88%. Not too bad for a first paper, and this would have been the first full formal report that would have been written. And so an 88.3% is not a bad score on a first formal report as it's written. But you can see how we can go through with the rubric and how I would score just the paper. I'm not scoring what she actually did in the lab. That gets scored on other rubrics. I'm not scoring the product because that gets scored on other rubrics. I'm really just scoring the writing and the paper and what's being done here. And like I said, there's a lot that could be done to clean this article up. There's a lot of language. There's a few formatting things, but by and large, what she did really well. And so that's an example of how we're going to go through and do formal reports. Now, like I said, what I'm going to do is give you guys a template and you can work from the template. So I'll put together an Excel template for you guys to be able to use. I'll see if I can get it to also get imported into Google Docs so that you can use Google Docs if you don't happen to have Excel or Microsoft Word. And I don't know, I've got some things to work in on my end. Let me stop the screen share. And let me ask you guys, or maybe even before I stop the screen share, let me ask you guys if there are any questions. And kind of, have I done a fairly decent job of showing you sort of what the expectations are? I've shown you some articles that have really good language and detail in them from a professional article. I've shown you a student article, and you can clearly see the differences between a student article and a professional article. What you're striving for is sort of that professional language. And so they've got two good models there that I've given you to show you. We've shown how to use the rubric and how to go through and how to score a paper, a student paper, and the types of things that I'm looking for. I don't know what else I could do here. Besides answer some questions. So I think what I'm going to do is I think that I'm going to create a couple of lab exercises. We went through and we did laboratory notebooks first. Today we've done more formal reports. I think what I'm going to do is create two modules. The first module, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up a laboratory notebook that I want you to go through and score with the rubric. And I want you to see how it scores out with the rubric so that you get practice doing that. And I think I'm going to do the same thing with a formal report. I'm going to put together a formal report and have you guys score it with the rubric as an activity to go through and do and see if you can pick out a proper scoring in the different sections and where there might be errors, not in the chemistry, but just in the layout of the report. And that might be more complicated. I'll have to think about how I'm going to do that. The first one, the laboratory notebook, is easier. The formal report might be harder. Maybe I'll just have to do a section of the formal report so it doesn't get too technical. All right, let's stop the share. I think we've been going now for a good while. I think that's about it for what I want to do today. I think I'm going to cut lab a little bit short today since we don't have actual activities that we've been doing. So I'll work on getting some of those things up tonight, particularly the laboratory notebook one, because I think I can do that faster. The formal report one might take me a day or two more. And I'm not sure what we'll do when we come back. We may move into looking at waste and how to do waste logs and how to do some of the other types of record keeping things that a chemist needs to keep track of. We'll keep on this idea of all of the things that we can do that are sort of like paperwork things before we start getting into laboratory techniques, because I'd rather not do the laboratory techniques in Zoom. I'd rather save those for when we come back to in-person in that fourth week after the 22nd. So I think I'm going to call it for today, unless you guys have any questions. All right. Well, I'll let you stay online. If you have any questions, you're welcome to stay online. I'll stay online and answer any questions off camera and off of the recording. I'm going to end it from here. And I'm going to bid you guys a good morning and let you go from here. Okay. Thanks.